It's the 29th of March 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. If the internet is under attack, will BuzzFeed respond with 21 90s toys that could be lost in the slaughter? What happens when the Lynx effect is to actively exclude women? Why do American conservatives fetishise the Constitution, and why is this so lewd and obscene? And is a fungal biologist a fun guy to be around? But before we begin the begging slot, if you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All the donations help us pay the server bills and associated costs with running the podcast, and we really do appreciate them. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. We start this week with a story that you might have seen about a huge attack on the internet which slowed it down. But did it really happen? To find out, Liz Luckendorf has been speaking to Andy Helsall, who's the campaign officer for the Pirate Party, who, as you might expect, knows a lot about these things. So she started by asking him, what actually did happen?
The basic gist of this is as silly as it gets. It's a spat between a hosting company, essentially, and a group that hosts what are essentially lists of spammers and malcontents and evildoers and whatever else you want to call them on the internet. And it's spilled out into the public domain for a number of reasons, probably primarily because there's been some pretty good press releases coming out from Cloudflare, who I believe are doing some of the mitigation work on this cyber attack. And Cyberbunker itself, which has been, I think, throwing out a couple of bits and pieces about being unhappy with Spam House being the repository of all this information about who people should block. But it is, at the end of the day, just a spat between two organizations.
Just for people who may not know who these organizations are, who is Spam House and who are Cyberbunker?
Well, Spam House is a really interesting one. I used to maintain some web servers and some mail servers a long time ago, and the biggest problem we had was spam. And the way we used to deal with it was we used to make lists of people who spammed us a lot, and then we used to block them so we didn't have to deal with the email. As time went by, people got together, put lists of these things and shared them around. Spam House is essentially that writ large. It's an organization that makes lists of people who appear to be spammers and and make that available to people so that they can block the, especially email traffic. That's what they're known for. That's where the name comes from. And they are the most trusted one at the moment. So they're the big player. They're the guy who, if you end up on their list of spammers, which isn't that impossible to do, even if you aren't a spammer, if you have a badly configured mail relay or whatever else, you could find yourself on a list there. Whilst Cyberbunker is the opposite end of this, I suppose, they provide hosting for anybody as long as it's not terrorism related and as long as it's not child pornography. So if you're a spammer, which isn't illegal in many places, then you can get your hosting from them. And I think you can see where the clash may have come from.
So it's a DDoS attack that's going on against Spam House right now.
That's what it's I believe it's a DNS reflection attack distributed. That's right. Basically, what that means is that somebody has decided to make a huge number of DNS requests. That's essentially requests to translate a web address like www.google.com to a load of DNS servers, but pretending that the request is coming from somebody else. So these DNS servers, which are usually very large, very capable with decent network connections, are then responding to Spam House rather than the bot or the compromised router that's making the request. And the actual data that's being sent back to Spam House is massively bigger than the initial request. So you end up in this position where for a small amount of traffic out, you can force a very large amount of traffic to go and be fired at somebody else.
How many different types of attacks are there? Is this like a more sophisticated attack, or is this just one of many different types of attacks you can use for this sort of thing?
There are huge numbers of attacks that you can use for this sort of thing. This kind of attack is, I suppose, it's a cheap one in the sense that you don't need to have a huge amount of bandwidth yourself. Well, you need to have a fair amount, but you can multiply the amount of traffic that actually hits your target by a factor of 100 or more. So it's a good attack in the sense that it's one where you get quite a lot for your attacking power. There are many different types of attacks. And this, again, comes down to the fact that, you know, the systems that we're talking about, DNS is distributed. It's intended to make life easy. You make a request, you find out your thing. It's all nice and great as long as everybody plays nicely. It's not designed to be secure or to prevent this kind of attack.
All the articles that I've read said they're coming in short bursts. What does that exactly mean? They just stop attacking after a while and then reattack?
Well, that would be my reading of it. I'm actually having difficulty finding any proper data about the volumes of traffic that are going in at a particular time. When I first looked at this, I looked at it from the context of the news stories we saw that the internet was was burning down. And I couldn't actually find very much to back that up. The UK internet sort of traffic statistics from various people seem to suggest that traffic was about what you'd expect normally anyway.
Again, you've been referring to it, but there is this kind of hyperbolic response to this that it was slowing the internet worldwide, but this doesn't seem to be the case then.
It doesn't seem to be the case. It's a huge amount of traffic to be aimed at one person. It isn't a huge amount of traffic in terms of the internet more broadly, but it clearly did some damage in the virtual sense to Cloudflare, who were dealing or mitigating the attack. They had to take their London hub out of their distributed network, I believe. I mean, the classic point here is that if the attacker is using compromised computers, if your computer at home happens to be the one that's, you know, part of this attack, then you might find that there's an issue with, you know, with your machine, your connectivity. If you're on an ISP where there are a lot of machines that are being used in this attack, you might find that your little section of the internet is running more slowly. But the reports of the BBC going, the BBC slowing down, and people having difficulty looking at Netflix in the States, and all this kind of stuff, it's unlikely that it was on a global scale. It's far more likely to have been a problem very, very locally to them. And some of the more sort of insane stories that we've seen about this kind of attack taking down everything from control of power grids through to schools and hospitals is a bit, well, it's not, it's massive hyperbole. Most of these things, even when you see, you know, the FBI's website being taken down, that's the FBI's website taken down. It's not all of their back-end operations. The chances are they probably wouldn't have noticed, you know, in terms of their day-to-day work. And I believe the same is true for Spam House at the moment. Their website is under attack. I don't think it's actually gone entirely down yet, but certainly the service of distributing their lists still continues to occur. The impact at the moment, I think, is far more local than some of the reporting would lead us to believe. And I think for a long time, I don't think we're going to see an attack that actually seriously has an impact on the internet for a long time, unless it's one that's accidental to a certain extent. We've had, you know, technical failures that have caused more immediate problems than this attack has.
That was the kind of interesting point, that if there was literally just this ridiculous little bun fight between these two things that was affecting the massive infrastructure that is the internet and our worldwide communications, it would point to a really huge fundamental flaw in the way this is structured.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the line that everybody likes to use about the internet is that it roots around damage, and it interprets censorship as damage, and it interprets this kind of thing as damage as well. And it's true. The internet is incredibly resilient. You know, for most businesses, it's easy enough to mitigate an issue like this as long as it's not on this scale. And most attacks aren't on this scale. And frankly, the scale of these attacks is getting bigger. People keep pointing out that the traffic numbers are bigger, and it's getting bigger, and that's going to be a huge problem. But that's largely down to the fact that 5-6 years ago, we all had 2 megabit broadband connections and were very happy. And now I'm sat here with 120 megabit broadband connection, and I'm still getting annoyed when YouTube buffers. So, you know, technology marches on. These attacks will appear to be bigger. But frankly, I'd be much more worried about something like the Stuxnet attack on Iran, the kind of more sabotage-y attacks rather than cyber taking down a website type attack that we see and that get a lot of results a lot of media attention because a website has disappeared off the internet, or because Twitter is being DDoSed, or because Slashdot has looked at a blog post somewhere and taken it off the internet. I mean, at the end of the day, these attacks can't last that long, and they don't tend to do any massive or real damage that can't be recovered from.
That was brilliant, and I think I understand it better. And I wasn't terribly worried about the internet to begin with, but now I can be very much less worried about the internet and it falling over because of two people having a spat or two organizations. Yeah. So thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk to us.
No, thank you. It was brilliant. Thank you very much.
The big news in America at the moment is the sequestration, which, to cut a long story short, is a massive government spending cut across the board because the two parties can't work together and do anything about it, and the Republicans are happy to play chicken with the national debt ceiling to get their way. Why is this important to us, though? Well, aside from the fate of the entire world economy, one of the casualties of this is NASA, as Sandra Prow now explains.
I'm speaking today with Keith Cowing, editor-in-chief of SpaceRef.com and founder and editor of NASA Watch. Keith is an astrobiologist who has extensive experience with NASA policy and leadership, and I've asked him to join us today to discuss the effects of the U.S. government's budgetary sequestration on NASA, particularly in light of the announcement of the suspension of all outreach activities by the agency. Keith, first of all, for our listeners who are primarily outside the United States, can you explain a bit about the sequester and what it means?
Well, here in the States, like most democracies, we don't do budgets well. And sometimes politicians make decisions that they claim they never want to implement, but then they don't do the work they claim they're going to do, and suddenly the unfathomable or the unexpected becomes real. In the case of the sequester, this was something that was done as a sort of compromise between different political factions in the States well more than a year ago. The idea being that if they can't reach a decision about the budget by a certain date, that these automatic cuts that are very draconian and are almost, you know, completely irrelevant to content were to occur. Well, again, our Congress didn't make the decisions they thought they were going to make, and now they're faced with the automatic cuts that are now kicking in. So it's sort of like putting a gun to your head and pulling the trigger, but expecting the bullet to not necessarily leave the gun while it's leaving the gun.
Well, we're seeing some broad outreach activities going on. What exactly was affected by the sequester?
Well, there's something that happens here in Washington almost every year. Sometimes it's worse than others, where one agency or one government or one program is faced with budget cuts, and they want to try and, you know, make people know how severe it is. And the game is called the Washington Monument Game. And this came from something that happened 15, 20 years ago where the Department of Interior, which manages a lot of parks and monuments in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere, wanted to make it clear how bad the budget was going to be. So they said, well, we'll have to close the Washington Monument. Now, they could have closed anything. They could have cut down the number of toilet paper rolls in the bathrooms. But they decided to just try and make the point with closing the Washington Monument. So that's sort of become the line here. It's sort of like, well, that's a Washington Monument ploy. Every agency is responding differently to the sequester. Some of them are cutting travel. Some of them are cutting back programs. Some of them are laying off employees. For some reason that I and a lot of other people cannot understand, NASA decided to cut back travel for its employees to save money. Now, when you ask them how much money it's going to save, it's in the millions, which compared to other things they could cut is a drop in the bucket. The other thing, which for reasons that just baffle me and many others, they decided to take all the education and public outreach, the interaction between NASA and the taxpayers, and said, well, we're going to pull all that back and then decide whether we're going to do any of it, and if so, what's the most important, and we'll probably not do all of it. Now, no matter how you figure this out, the amount of money that they could save from this is a pittance. It probably costs more money to stop and think about how much you're spending than you'll actually save. But here in the States, we love drama. We love to say, oh, look, you know, if this happens, we'll do this. And at NASA, they've probably made the worst decisions of any agency.
So why do you think NASA chose public outreach for the cuts? Because that's probably the most visible thing. I guess that's the Washington Monument ploy.
That would at least imply that there's a strategy. And I don't think there is. And as a matter of fact, I know there's not. It's pretty much they're cutting the things that they can because they can. And, of course, when they did this, the outcry was rather prompt and widespread. And, of course, what NASA did is they took the first memo that they issued informally but formally and leaked it. They followed up with another memo, which confused things further, followed by yet another the other day. So, again, there is no strategy here. They're reacting to things as they happen and then trying to fix their mistakes as they happen, only to make more mistakes. So you'd be generous to think that they're planning this. They're not.
If they had to plan for sequester, do you think there were other areas that probably would have been better to cut? I notice on NASA Watch, I think you were talking about some of the, if they were going to cut outreach, some of the redundant websites they have and items like that.
everybody I talk to at NASA, I raise that issue, and they say, absolutely. You know, why is it that we have three or four, depending on how you look at it, websites for one mission? And they say, of course we'd like to cut that, but that requires somebody at NASA headquarters to stand up on a soapbox, pull out their knife, and take a rather daring action to order somebody to do something at one of the centers, and there's a political cost every time you do that. So they're not going after that. That would be hard. So they're not going after that. They're going after the easy stuff, again, which goes back to why they picked this stuff. You'd think there would be more of a logic to this, but there's also this weird habit at NASA. When I worked there, the action to budgets would often be, well, we'll take 5% out of everybody's budget. Well, okay, you know, maybe you do that the first time because you're being fair. But after a while, you realize, you know, why am I penalizing everybody? There are some projects that I've already decided are more important than others. Why don't I just cancel one of them and leave all the others funded? But no, 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 they don't do that at NASA. No, they want to spread the hurt around. And that's sort of the flip side of this. They want to spread the hurt around so everybody has some pain, which means everybody's going to try and not have the pain, which means the ones that do get cut are the ones that are least able to defend themselves. So it's this weird sort of Darwinism at work, where it's the survival of the fittest.
Well, we've all kind of, over here, we've been enjoying Chris Hadfield's outreach and his videos, and a lot of that appears to have been coordinated by the Canadian Space Agency. Do you think that NASA will continue to encourage a lot of videos and a lot of internet traffic from astronauts on orbit?
Well, it depends. And it usually it ends up, I've known enough friends of mine who've been up there that some people are chatty and like to write and take pictures, and some don't. And it's just some crew members are better at it than others. What Chris Hadfield has done is he's taken the whole notion of involving people, and he's lifted it an order of magnitude beyond what anybody's ever done before. The only one who comes close is maybe Don Pettit. And this is just the fact that Chris is a very good communicator, he's a very good photographer, and he's Canadian. I have a Canadian business partner, and it's something I've noticed about Canadians. You know, here in the States, we say, well, they're a lot like us. Yeah, and sometimes they're more like us than we think, and they're better at it. It's Canadians have always been are very good at leveraging their resources in space, and you look at what they do, and you always think they have more of a budget than they do. It's very creative. And what they've done here is they said, well, we're going to have a commander up there. They have let Chris Hadfield do everything he can to get the most out of this, to bring the most people in. And he's got more followers than any astronaut's ever gotten while on orbit. He sent down more material. He's got people begging for more. And, you know, you talk to folks at NASA, and they're sort of now learning the lesson. And I think it's just interesting that a Canadian is the one that would be able to best demonstrate the utility of the space station back to NASA, which dwarfs the CSA in terms of its resources. It's sort of like soft power. All you need is a camera, a computer, and a downlink. That's all you really need. You don't need a bunch of people sitting in a room doing messaging and things like that. Having people up there sharing their experiences, playing their music and so forth, in their off time when they're not doing other stuff, I think it's compelling, and I know people have been paying attention, and I know NASA's going to have to answer to that the next time they send somebody up, because, you know, people are going to say, what? You're only sending 20 pictures a day, Chris Hadfield, 100.
How do you think the budget cuts are affecting NASA's cooperations with other agencies and also the reputation and appearance of NASA in the eyes of other agencies that we're working with?
I have to say that anybody in any country other than the U.S. who've worked with the U.S. and vice versa is long become accustomed to each country's quirks. I can recall when I worked on Space Station Freedom back in the 90s that there was a time when the Europeans could only travel in Europe. So we had meetings over there because they couldn't come here. And then the Japanese couldn't come here, but they could go to Europe. So we went to Europe again. And then we couldn't go anywhere because Newt Gingrich shut the government down. So, you know, this is, you get used to this after a while. And of course, the flip side of all this is, you know, while Russia is like being nasty to the U.S. right now, and, you know, you don't see any evidence that that's affecting space station operations, where it's pretty much a Russian-American station with Europeans and Japanese and Canadians on board. So some of these things are actually amazingly isolated. So I think they all understand this. They know it's not the fault of the agencies. It's the fault of legislatures and so forth. I mean, you're in Europe, so you tell me. I mean, every week it seems to be another country is about to blow up because it can't pay its bills. That has to be affecting how ESA works, I would think, as well.
I do notice you do have a petition on whitehouse.gov. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I guess I mean I'm indirectly responsible for that. I mean I was the one who posted all these memos that NASA still won't officially release but confirms to be authentic. And you know there's a lot of the people who do education and public outreach are the very same people I just mentioned who tend to get up in people's faces and shout and get attention drawn to their interest, which is space. So it's only natural that they would just start complaining. And now these days, getting a petition at the White House is one of the ways to draw attention to things, because people write stories about the fact that you have a petition. And just a few months ago, there was a joke about building a Death Star, and it turned into a petition to get enough signatures, and the White House had to respond. And the way they responded was a classic, I think, government response, which, you know, in terms of humor, that really poked fun at the government, but really, you know, just took it an opportunity to discuss the issue. And because these people now are complaining about education and public outreach possibly being cut, they put this petition up. It's worded somewhat incorrectly. It's the sequester isn't cutting this. It's NASA's decision how to respond to the sequester. It's a subtle difference that's lost to most people. But that said, I haven't checked, but they've got if they keep on this path, they might actually get 100,000 signatures.
We'll definitely put the link up to it, and we'll see how many of our U.S. listeners would like to sign it. So, Keith, thank you very much, and I appreciate your time. I'll talk to you soon.
Oh, my pleasure.
Now, if the adverts are to be believed, the very act of wearing Lynx deodorant, which is known as Axe in America and Europe, will make women attracted to you, just from the way you smell. Personally, I'm not so sure of this, otherwise by now, surely, they'd have created a deodorant that makes you smell of a petrol station forecourt, which, as I'm sure we can all agree, is the best smell. Anyway, as you'll know, the marketing for Lynx is usually a little bit sexist, but in this latest campaign, involving a competition to go into space, they seem to have surpassed themselves. As I found out when I spoke to Kate Arkless-Gray, who is trying to take on the Lynx marketing machine. I started by asking her why she wants to go into space.
Well, one reason, my name is too long, so I decided to shorten it and just call myself Space Kate. And it was about 3 years ago, I met a guy from NASA. And I've always found, I mean, space is just exciting. It's really amazing. But it's one of those things that you all dream about when you're a kid, but then you have to do something proper, you know, something sensible. And space is, it's kind of unreachable. It's not really real. I kind of say it's a bit like Father Christmas. You know that Father Christmas exists, but you're never going to meet him. And the same is true of astronauts, of people from NASA. You know, they probably exist, but they're not really real people, are they? And over the last few years, I've realised, well, yes, they are real people. And in fact, they're very real people. And the work they do is very fascinating. And I love it. So I've been sharing my experiences, chasing shuttles and talking to astronauts and meeting rocket scientists. And then this opportunity came to enter a competition to try and go to space. And so, of course, I jumped at it.
So what actually was the competition? I mean, it's Lynx, who are known as Axe in, I think, America and Europe. But isn't that teenage boys? You're a woman.
I know. How dare I be a woman? My goodness. A woman interested in space. Well, that's kind of how Lynx would have you have it. And I know that they're a male brand, and I've had this thing thrown at me. Well, they're a boys brand. You know, why should you care? Well, the reason I care is the way that this has been marketed. It's very, very much, we are looking for 22 brave men to go into space. Leave a man, return a hero. And the advert itself portrays this poor, helpless woman, a very beautiful girl. Oh, woe is me, I'm stuck in a burning building and I can't help myself. And then along comes this hunky macho fireman and he rescues her. But she doesn't even stop to say thank you before she's like, oh, I'm so indecisive. Oh, look, there's an astronaut. I'm going to ditch this guy. It's not a very nice way to portray girls as just the trophies or the slightly helpless things. And two, I mean, I know that these all have a sense of humour. Don't get me wrong. You know, most Lynx adverts, they're not marketing at me. They use sex to sell. That's fine. Whatever. I'm not really het up about it. What really upset me about this was the fact that it's always men that are portrayed as astronauts. And it doesn't actually advertise their product in their usual way. Usually, young boy who's probably feeling a bit underconfident, and the whole marketing message of the brand is, Well, hey, young unconfident boy, you want to hook up with some girls? Spray yourself on our product and they'll all come running. Well, this advert doesn't really say that at all. This advert kind of says, hey, young geeky boy, even if you're a hunky fireman, you're screwed. You need to be a male astronaut, otherwise you're not going to get anywhere.
One of the things that bewildered me when I saw the advert was, I'd want to be an astronaut regardless of whether, you know, whether women were attracted to me or not. It doesn't make sense.
No, exactly. Space is cool because it's really cool. Not because you might get a hot girl who's just been rescued from a burning building coming running over to you. And what they could have done, you know, they have a very clear style in their adverts. And what I've said in one of, well, several of my blog posts about this is, you know, why didn't they decide to sort of challenge those and perhaps have a female astronaut and only the boy who's wearing the, you know, Lynx Apollo new scent would attract this brave, heroic female astronaut? Because you know what? Girls have been into space.
So you're now challenging this head on, and you've entered the Lynx competition where you've got to sort of collect votes in order to win a trip into space. I presume it's on, like, the new Virgin Galactic.
It's not, actually. It's with X-Core. Yeah, the other one. So, well, you know, again, somebody said, well, oh, I don't know, if you're so mad about this, why don't you boycott the competition? And I kind of thought, yeah, that's not really going to have any effect, is it? You know, if I don't enter the competition, I'm going to be doing exactly what they want, which is, you know, having lots of boys enter their competition. So I thought, well, I will enter, and I will point out that it's not very helpful. And there are a few things here. So firstly, I know that some people will say, you know, if you've lost your sense of humour, get a grip. Well, actually, there's research that shows that sexism is alive and, well, I don't want to say alive and well, but sexism still exists in the lab. And one of the things they found is that it's the enduring cultural stereotypes that women aren't so good at science, or it's not really their place to do science, that actually does have an effect on their chances of being promoted. And that's not just by men promoting them, but even women as well. And I just feel like, you know, here's this huge multi-million pound global advertising campaign once again saying, hey, female trophy, hey, hunky science, you know. The other thing we found, which made me very cross, because Lynx said to me when I rang them up, I rang up their press office and they said, oh, sexist, do you think? What do you think people, no, I didn't think anybody would think that, would they? And I just thought, oh my goodness, head in my hands, you know. Okay, they said, look, we're not trying to exclude anybody, you know, girls can enter. And indeed, that is true. In the UK and America, women could enter, and I did. But when I looked into it, I had a friend in Mexico who wanted to enter, and the rules specifically stated in Mexico that you had to be a man. And we found that was the case in 8 different countries, including Russia, who sent the first woman to space. You should think, oh, for goodness sake. Except we kicked up a big fuss about this and discovered, with a bit of help from a friend of mine who works at Forbes in the States, we found that actually this even went against Unilever, the parent brand. It went against their own guidelines, their own advertising guidelines. It also is potentially legally unsound in a couple of places. And we've got them to change their mind and update the terms and conditions. So all around the world, if you're a woman, you can enter this competition.
Following this, you've been blogging about it, you've appeared on Women's Hour, you've been in The Telegraph and so on, and at the time of us speaking, you're currently at number 5, I think, in the overall vote.
Amazing.
Have you had any further response from Unilever at all? I mean, are they worried? Have they said anything like, oh no, what happens if a girl wins? Or
no, nothing like that. So what they do is they're going to take the top 200 people, this is how it works in the UK. In other countries, it's different. In the UK, the top 200 people will get selected and then would have to go along to a live event where you're put through some mental and physical challenges. And then there's the judge's discretion as well. And they pick 4 people who get sent off to sort of space camp in Florida to do some astronaut training, kind of astronaut training. And then they pick 1 person from the UK to go. Now, they did say that, of course, there would be no disadvantage to me being a woman if I got through to that next stage. Because I asked, thinking, you know, it said that your scores on the physical and mental tests didn't necessarily mean that you would get through if you had the highest scores. There was still some discretion, which kind of made me think, if they're looking for a nice, you know, figure in their advert, they're probably going to go with somebody that their brand is promoting to. We shall see.
Give us the details, because I imagine everyone listening will want to support you. How can we vote for you, and how can we hope, you know, get you to the next stage?
Well, all the details about how to vote for me are on my website, which is spacekate.com, and that will also prove to you that I'm not just some random girl that's decided that I want to kick up a fuss or that I'd like to go to space on a jolly. Hopefully that will show you that I really am interested in getting more and more people interested and excited by space. And I do my best to share the experiences and the contacts that I have with amazing people. And you can also follow me on Twitter, again, nice and simple, at SpaceKate. And say hello, and I shall be very pleased to hear from you.
Lovely. And we'll let you get some sleep, and we'll put links to all that on the Pod Delusion website. Kate Arkless Gray, or Space Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, if American conservatives love the Constitution so much, why don't they marry it? Well, I guess they can't, because marriage is only between a man and a woman, as they say. This week, the Supreme Court in America has been hearing arguments over Proposition 8, which was essentially a referendum in California that voted to ban gay marriage. One of the possible outcomes is that the law could be overturned as unconstitutional, which is good. But is being unconstitutional a good answer to political questions like this? This week, Salim Fadli has been speaking to an academic who thinks that Americans should sometimes ignore the Constitution.
According to most politically aware American citizens, the word unconstitutional is synonymous with wrong. Suggesting that politicians should enact policy that goes against the Constitution is almost like suggesting that law should be intentionally wrong. I spoke with Mike Seidman, who is a professor of constitutional law at the Georgetown University Law Center. I began by asking Mike, why is it that so many Americans seem to read their constitution as if it were a form of religious scripture?
You are certainly right about the way many Americans feel about the Constitution, and I think it's hard for people in the rest of the world to understand it. The Constitution is not the Bible. Treating it like the Bible is just a fundamental mistake. In terms of why Americans think this, this Constitution has come to be a kind of symbol of national unity. As long as it's just symbolic, that's fine. But unfortunately, this is a symbol that also has some pretty bad effects on our politics and public policy.
I wonder if you think there's something particularly Protestant about the idea of making an entire country or one's entire political outlook subservient to a written document.
Some scholars have suggested that people who think that they can have sort of direct access to the truth about government through the Constitution, that that is a kind of Protestant view as opposed to a Catholic view, that where access to truth or to religious truth is mediated through some other organization. This is all speculation. Wherever it comes from, it is a fact that Americans treat the Constitution, or many Americans treat it, almost as if it were scripture. And that has the effect of cutting off debates that I think we ought to have, because there are provisions in the Constitution that are very old, archaic, and get in the way of sound government.
Are you really suggesting that American lawmakers and Supreme Court judges should be allowed to disregard the Constitution?
Well, I'm actually suggesting just that, but I do want to take a little of the sting out of the answer. I'm arguing that we ought to get rid of constitutional obedience. It doesn't follow from that that we ought to disobey everything that happens to be in the Constitution. There are some provisions in the Constitution that are wise and some that are absolutely vital. And in that category, I would put things like fundamental civil liberties, like freedom of press and speech and religion, and guarantees of liberty and due process and property. And then there are other provisions in the Constitution that nobody would claim are essential for a just government, but the fact is we've been doing them that way a long time, and it's probably not worth changing. So, for example, the fact that the president serves for 4 years rather than six, or that, you know, we have a two-chambered legislative body, or we have states, those are things that just probably are not worth messing with at this late date. So here's the basic point. To the extent that things are wise, or on our all things considered judgment, we ought to do them, they ought to be done because they're wise or because of our all things considered judgment. But we ought not to do anything just because a text written 225 years ago by people who had no idea what America is like demands that we do them. We ought to make our own judgment for our own country in the 21st century.
I think implicit in that argument is a criticism of a way that debate is often ended. Someone will propose something and then someone else will reply by saying it's unconstitutional, and that's supposed to be the end of a discussion.
When you think about the things that we owe each other as citizens of a liberal democracy, one thing we owe to each other is to give reasons to our opponents for why we think that something ought or ought not to be done. So if somebody has a proposal and I don't like it, I have an obligation to tell that the person why. It's not a good answer just to say, well, this is something you're not allowed to think because of a document written 250 years ago. In the UK, you've had two houses of parliament for a very long time. The House of Lords has been selected in a particular way, but some people thought that wasn't such a good idea. And so they proposed changing the way the House of Lords was selected, and there was a debate, and in fact, there was change. In the United States, many people think that the Senate is not chosen in the right way. As it happens, every state gets two senators, no matter how large or how small, and people think that's really not fair. But in the United States, you're not allowed to debate that. The complete answer to the question, should we have a Senate that's differently composed, is you can't do that because the Constitution prohibits it. And that's not a good enough answer.
I'm thinking that maybe judges and politicians already ignore the Constitution to quite a significant extent. Thinking of some of the most celebrated legal and political decisions, Obamacare, even the Emancipation Proclamation, all of these defied the Constitution in quite significant ways, didn't they?
You mentioned the Emancipation Proclamation that ended the property right in slaves in large parts of the United States. Almost everybody at the time the proclamation was issued by President Abraham Lincoln, including Lincoln himself, thought that the Constitution prohibited the ending of slavery in places where it already existed. Nonetheless, Lincoln went ahead and did it. And in the beginning, he had kind of a paper-thin constitutional argument. But by the end of the Civil War, it was very clear to everybody that this was a central war aim and that slavery was going to be ended not by constitutional means but by force of arms. And that's one of the formative experiences in the history of the United States. It's a little much when people say, well, gee, we just can't have constitutional obligation because the United States would disintegrate. Some of the acts of constitutional obligation have been really important in preventing the disintegration of the United States.
And looking more recently, to some extent, I have to agree with some conservative critics that the decision to uphold Obamacare doesn't really seem to have had any grounds in constitutional principles at all. It seems to be purely a political decision.
Here's another real problem about constitutional obligation. Many clauses in the United States Constitution are exceedingly vague. For example, what was at stake in the Obamacare case is what it means to regulate interstate commerce. So to decide that, you have to decide what interstate commerce means. When language is that open-ended, what inevitably happens is that liberals read the language to embody liberal principles, and conservatives read the language to embody conservative principles. It's hardly a coincidence in the Obamacare case that every justice appointed by a Republican president thought that Obamacare violated the Commerce Clause, and every justice appointed by a Democratic president thought that it didn't. What you end up having is, instead of the Constitution actually resolving political disputes, you have liberals and conservatives beating each other around the head and shoulders, complaining that each side has violated our foundational commitments. And that's not a useful way of having a discussion. We need to lower the temperature, not to raise it, and we need to start talking about what makes sense in terms of a policy rather than what these very vague words written a very long time ago mean.
You can find links to Mike and his research via our show notes, which can be found at poddelusion.co.uk. This is Salim Fadli for The Pod Delusion.
Now, last Saturday was also a big day down at the Royal Holloway University in Egham, who held their annual science festival. And as you might have expected, we were there. In fact, we were part of the festival. We spent the day broadcasting live from the bar, speaking to some of the scientists who work there, and over the next few weeks, we'll be giving you some of the highlights. So first up, here's fungal biologist Alan Gange. A shroom, he knows his stuff.
When we were at the Royal Holloway Science Festival, we interviewed 6 scientists over the course of the afternoon. We're going to bring you them all over the next few podcasts, as all the scientists were enthusiastic and wonderful interviewees that we couldn't possibly just give you a few minutes each. First up, as James mentioned, is Professor Alan Gange, head of the Biological Sciences Department, who's the man to go to for mushrooms. He was kind enough to even answer our most basic questions about fungi.
Take it away.
I guess the first thing to do is, introduce us to, people watching on the internet right now, what you do.
Okay, I'm head of the Biological Sciences Department here at Royal Holloway, and my interest is in mushrooms, fungal fruiting in particular, and trying to understand what makes a fungus fruit.
Okay, so we're going to start way back at the beginning. What is a fungus? It's not an animal. Is it a plant?
No, it's not a plant either. To scientifically describe it, it's a multicellular organism, so it's a bit more involved than a bacterium. But it's not a plant. Fungi exist in an entire kingdom of their own. And they are some of the most important organisms on the planet. If we didn't have fungi, then nothing would decompose and nutrients wouldn't be recycled. Ecosystems would fall to a halt.
When do we know when the first fungi appeared?
Well, there are fossil records that go back as far as the Devonian age. So probably before then. The problem is, how do you fossilise a fungus, of course, because there is more or less no material there. Yeah. But there are plant remains from those times which contain structures which look very similar to today's fungi that we see in plant roots today. So we can say that at least to Devonian times and probably before. So they are very, very ancient.
So I think most of people's experience will be things like eating a mushroom or maybe finding it in the woods. Mm-hmm. What's the diversity? There's a great variety of trees and things, but what's the variety like for fungus?
It's extraordinary. We have probably no idea as how many fungal species there are. Estimates range up to several million. Much more likely that that's an underestimate. In Britain, we have something like 6,000 or 8,000 species currently identified. And most of those are what we call small brown jobs. So they are remarkably uninteresting. They're worthless from the point of view of human consumption. But again, they all do those important roles of decomposition.
So we have domesticated crops. Do we have domesticated fungi?
Yes, a few species. I mean, the white, so-called white mushroom that you buy in any supermarket is the commonest, and that's because so much scientific research has been done on how to cultivate it. It's easy.
There's lots of problems in places like Australia and I think here with invasive species. Does that happen with mushrooms?
Yes, and perhaps the most extraordinary tale of all is the most poisonous mushroom on the planet, which is called the death cap. Now, the death cap, its scientific name is Amanita phalloides, and It's a pretty uninteresting mushroom. It's olive green in colour. It's not spectacularly coloured in any way. It's quite large. It's about 8-10 centimetres tall. And it's fairly rare in the UK. But it was introduced into North America. And it's become an invasive species in North America, through woodlands and, curiously, along the two coastal edges, down the west coast and the east coast of America. It's colonised different woodlands to where it occurs in its home range in Europe. And it's becoming very, very common. And it seems to be out-competing the local mushroom species in those forests, and they're disappearing. We don't know why, and in America there's a lot of research going on trying to understand just why this mushroom is so invasive.
And that's a poisonous...
It's highly poisonous.
so that's a really bad example of invasive.
Yes, that's right. What you really don't want is someone to go and eat this mushroom. A forkful will probably see you in hospital. If you ate one cap of this mushroom, which is slightly larger than the white mushrooms you buy, you would die. Unless you get your stomach pumped very quickly, that you've had it. It's a very unpleasant death indeed.
So watch where you collect mushrooms in the East and West Coast of America.
My advice is never, ever eat a mushroom unless you know what it is, unless an expert has identified it for you. The problem with mushrooms, and I think why they have this reputation, is that perfectly edible species, and some are absolutely delicious... Many of those look remarkably similar to ones which will cause you a lot of harm. And just trying to identify them by the morphology of what the mushroom looks like is a dangerous business.
So going from the more general stuff, what kind of research do you do with fungus at Royal Holloway?
Okay, well, I'm interested in the appearance of mushrooms in the wild during the year, a topic which we call phenology. Phenology is when an organism flowers or fruits or lays spawn, for example, or lays eggs. And... The story I've got is my father was an amateur mushroom hunter. He was not a scientist at all. He was a stonemason by trade. And ever since I was more or less old enough to walk, he dragged me around the New Forest collecting records of mushrooms. That was his hobby, to try and find out when mushrooms were fruiting. And he did this for 60 years.
Wow.
And when he retired, he bought himself a computer, taught himself how to use Excel, and he typed 65,000 records into Microsoft Excel.
Wow.
And we used that database to do an analysis of whether mushrooms are changing in their fruiting seasons ever since the 1950s, in effect since when I was born.
That's a pretty impressive data set.
It took me a year to conduct the analyses. It was something else. But what we did find was that over that 60-year period, mushrooms, many mushroom species, have changed their fruiting patterns in the UK dramatically. Many of them are appearing much earlier in the autumn now than they ever used to. And the fungus fruiting season, which usually goes from September to about the end of October, has more than doubled in that 50 years.
Wow. So you mentioned that there's different types of fruiting, like there's eggs and spores. Is there, like, what are the range of things of... What does fruiting entail, basically?
Fruiting entails the production of spores, ultimately. And those spores will be produced on a whole host of different types of structure. And it's actually that structure which is used by professional mycologists to identify the mushroom. With microfungi, that structure obviously is microscopic. You couldn't see it with the naked eye. But with the larger mushrooms, if you turn a mushroom over, you see it's got those little like lines, like plates almost. They're what we call the gills. And it's on those gills where the spores are produced. That mushroom is the spore-bearing structure. It's the fruit, in effect. The body of the mushroom is what we call the mycelium. And actually, that's much bigger than the mushroom. It's invisible. It's inside the soil, or it's inside leaf litter. It's inside, perhaps, dead wood. It's inside your cheese. But it's inside those sorts of substrates, and that's what's doing the decomposition. And so it's the mycelium that's the business end, if you like. That's the important part of the fungus.
So when I'm eating a giant cat mushroom thing, I'm eating all the spores?
Yes, you are. But you won't be eating all of them, because the spore-bearing cat will probably produce several billion spores. And it will already have produced some by the time that mushroom is picked. There's a huge argument in the UK as to whether mushroom picking actually affects the population of mushrooms. And in certain places, like the New Forest, where I grew up, you now have to have a licence to pick mushrooms. And scientifically, I cannot find any evidence whatsoever that picking mushrooms actually affects their populations.
Where are mushrooms sort of growing on a sort of industrial scale? Presumably there's mushroom farms.
Yes, somewhere. There are. Yes, I mean, they look not unlike a battery farm, to tell you the truth. It'll be a large barn-like structure, temperature-controlled, light-controlled. And humidity controlled as well. And that's more or less as simple as that. It's like a gigantic shed, but it's much more high-tech inside, of course.
So you mentioned that the fruiting change seasons have changed since the 50s. Do you think this might be climate change, or is it just different kind of patterns?
The one thing we do know is because all our records came from one very stable area, which is the New Forest, which has not seen great habitat changes over that time. We are convinced it's due to climate change. We know that the British climate has warmed since the 1950s. The last few winters, you might not think that's true, but certainly...
Especially not today.
Especially not today, but it's certainly it is so. If you look at the overall 60-year trend, British climate is warmer than it used to be. The interesting thing is that the climate signal that the meteorologists have discovered, by the signal I mean when the climate began to change, is very clearly stuck in the late 1970s. That's when the climate began to get warmer. And the mushroom fruiting patterns, the changes, start at exactly that point. And I'm absolutely sure that it's the warming of the temperature which makes the mycelium grow more. The mycelium can then acquire more resources, greater rate of decomposition, and it can produce more mushrooms, and it produces those mushrooms earlier.
So could mushrooms be used to monitor climate change? If a miracle happened and the world got its act together and managed to rein in like CO2 emissions, would we see the fruiting patterns change again, and would that be like a good bellwether of what's going on?
Yes, absolutely. The one thing which we've discovered is that the sorts of studies which I have done have been repeated across the world with almost every taxonomic group you can imagine. But what makes our study different is that the mushrooms have the greatest and most plastic response of any taxonomic group. And by that I mean mammals, birds, fish, plants, whatever. Mushrooms seem to be much more plastic in their responses to the weather. So if we then went through a period of global cooling, as it were, I'm absolutely sure that what you say would happen, and the mushroom season would revert back to what it used to be. They are very, very sensitive indicators of climate change indeed, and I think that they could be very, very useful in the future in that respect.
Later on in the afternoon, we had Professor Rafael Yanes, also part of the Biological Science Department. But instead of fungus, we talked gene therapy.
So to start off, and to pronounce your name properly, because I'm terrible, can you tell us what you do and who you are?
So my name, pronounced the Spanish way, is Rafael Yanes. But after about 15 years in the UK, I've stopped bothering about that, and I just take it as it comes. I work here at Holloway. I've been here for about 6 years, and I work on genetic therapies, which effectively means trying to use genes as medicines to treat a number of diseases, some of them inherited, like the ones that are passed on from parents to children, but we can treat many other diseases like Parkinson's using the same technology.
We read a lot about gene therapies and things like that, but how, for someone who doesn't study genetics or know genetics, what is a gene therapy?
Okay, so genes are made of DNA, which is something inside in every one of our cells. A gene will normally make a protein. In actual truth, it would probably make several similar to each other, but we say one gene will make one protein. And if you are unlucky enough for one of those not to work, you may be lucky and then nothing will happen because others will make up for it, or you can be very unlucky and develop a very severe disease, like cystic fibrosis, as a big example. So what we try to do in using genetic therapies is use genes in order to try to treat diseases. In some cases, you can just use the gene that is faulty, but you can think of ways in which a gene may help a patient in a certain way, and you can treat perhaps cancer or AIDS, HIV infection, using genetic therapies.
So how do you actually administer a gene therapy? I'm imagining, you know, getting an injection of some sort. I can't imagine it because it's, you know, our genes.
It really depends on what you are trying to treat. The easiest way, because our bodies are very good at rejecting DNA. A DNA can come from a virus, and bodies don't like viruses, so they are very good at preventing them from coming in. So effectively, we hijack viruses. We take viruses. My lab works on HIV-related viruses. So we effectively take away all the bad from HIV, put in our cargo of interest, the gene that we want to deliver, and let that modified HIV, which carries no bad anymore, to deliver the gene to the cells. But how you do that depends on whether you are trying to treat a disease in the blood or in the eye or in muscle, and you may use different viruses as your carriers for the genes. But the principle is similar. We just take viruses and let them do the job.
In certain publications, like perhaps the Daily Mail, let's say, they might hyper-publicize something like, this is the X gene, like it's the gene for violence and stuff. How badly does the kind of therapies get represented?
Well, I mean, it was the same idea with cancer. People were looking for the magic bullet that would be able to cure all cancers. And now we know that every cancer is different, and every cancer needs a different type of treatment. So you really have to understand what type of cancer disease that person has in order to provide as much as possible individualized treatment. And with gene therapy, it's a little bit the same. You need to understand what the disease is. Depending on that, you will choose a particular type of vector and a gene perhaps to treat it. So there is no magic bullet. For every disease, we will have to develop a treatment. And that is effectively what is ongoing. Some diseases are leading, but the hope is that many more will follow. There is an International Rare Disease Research Consortium, which was set up a couple of years ago. The European Union, the United States, Canada, Japan are all part of that consortium. And their declared goal is to be able to treat 200 rare diseases by 2020 and to actually diagnose most of them. Because for many rare diseases, the problem is diagnose. Because people can take easily 5 to 7 years to be diagnosed properly, to be told what their disease is. And that really is a tragic issue.
And I guess the problem with rare diseases, it's not like, you know, a common cancer where there'll be loads of research money put in, because it's basically pharmaceutical companies can invest in it and then sell the drugs to various people who need to be treated. But rare diseases must be really difficult to get kind of the interest in them, because they're probably not going to be a profitable drug.
Having said that, that is all correct. But pharmaceutical companies are now retaking an interest in gene therapy because they can see that there are real successes happening in the field. But it is true that the government and in the UK, the Wellcome Trust, are really not investing significant amounts of money into rare disease research. At the moment, this type of research is strongly, very strongly supported by patient associations who support research on their diseases of interest. To give some examples, the Spinal Muscular Atrophy Trust, the Muscular Dystrophy Campaign. So they will focus on a small set of diseases of interest to them. And they support both the patients and the researchers. They provide grants for research. They provide information and support services for the patients. So they are critical. We wish and we would like to encourage both the big funders, the government, and the Wellcome Trust to consider that these diseases are a very big issue. If you take every disease is rare on its own, because by definition, they affect fewer than 1 in 2,000 people. But take 7,000 diseases altogether, and they affect 6% of people and take 20% of the health budget.
Oh, wow.
So that's big money. And the money that is coming or going into rare disease research at the moment is nowhere near 20% of the research funds available. So we would certainly like that to be matched. One more thing, in the current terrible financial climate, some patient associations are struggling to survive. And very, very sadly, for instance, the Primary Immunodeficiency Association folded last year. And that, for the patients affected by those diseases, is tragic because they lose all the support services.
Oh, wow.
If we can achieve that, then the next stage is to demonstrate whether we can cure an animal that is affected by the disease. And those animals are available, and we can do experiments and test whether the disease is cured in the animals. And if that is the case, really, you are in business, so to speak, and you can start considering the possibility of going on to a clinical trial where you will be able to treat the affected patients.
That was absolutely brilliant. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Liz.
You can find the full versions of these interviews on our YouTube channel or listen to them as podcasts on the Pod Delusion website. In the following weeks, we'll have some theoretical computer science, plant ecology, and child developmental psychology. Additionally, on the website, there are links to find out about Royal Holloway and their most excellent science festival. This has been Liz Lusendorf for the Pod.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can find links to over 3 years' worth of archives. You can also follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook, if you're into those sorts of things. Also on our website, you can subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month to help us keep doing this week in, week out. We really do appreciate all the donations, and they help us pay the server bills and all that sort of thing. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Liz Luckendorf, Sandra Prow, Adrian Tippetts, Salim Fadley, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz. The Sketch of the Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, pray silence for Pope Francis the First.
Ah, right then. Oh, no, now then. No, listen. You see, it is me, Francis, you see. No, not Francis of Assisi. No. Who would have thought it? No, you see, I was at home, just cooking for me, you know, fish on a Friday, as you know, yeah, minding my own business, I was. Then I get this call from the Vatican. Yes, I said, what do you think of the missionary position? I said, no, shut your face. No, stop it, no, come on now. No, there's no need for that. No. Common as muck, you lot know, though. No, I said, the missionary position? Well, I'm all in favour, broadly speaking, yes. And they said, oh, smashing, do you fancy being the Pope? Well, I said, yes, like a shot. I'm not stupid. Yes, you get to travel and you get some lovely clobber. No, you do, really, yes. Silky robes, a pointy hat, ruby slippers, yes. And you even get a palace. No, but humble Francis said no. No, he did. No, I said, I'm staying in 2 rooms at the Domus Santa Marta. And I am a martyr, yes, to my flock. No, flock, dear, no. Oh, shut your face. But when I got there, you see, yes, a bit of confusion, you see. Yes, there was. Yes, confusion. Yes. They said, well, you're a man of the poor. I said, am I? Oh, yes. And they said, well, listen, they'd heard one of my old pieces of material, you see. Yes, when I said, poor Francis. Yes, poor Francis, a few times. Just for dramatic effect, really, you see. No, but they got the wrong end of the stick. Yes, which turned out to be another thing they wanted to talk to me about. Yes, it was, yes. Still, I'm here now, and I'm not one to complain. No, I'm not. No, really, no. Anyhow, I can't stand around here chatting to you lot, no. Apparently today, you know, I'm doing some defrocking, and then I'm taking a fellow priest in hand. Yes, I know. Yes. Peace on you. Oh, grow up.